Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, President of the American Family Association.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the radio program, Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network, AFR, American Family Radio, and we are all across America, 38 states we reach into, maybe more now. I've lost track. It can't be more than 50, though. I think I'm right about that. Ed Battagliano co-hosting with me today. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Tim.
Would that be a safe statement?
Absolutely be a safe assessment.
Not more than 50.
Not more than 50 states.
Maybe not less than 38, but not more than 50 states.
Yeah. 38 states, I think, is current number.
We just so thrilled the Lord has blessed our ministry with expansion the last few months. So our new listeners in Huntsville, Alabama, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, New Orleans, where else we got? Corpus Christi?
Yeah, and then also Northern Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah, reaching into the Washington, D.C. area.
Northern Virginia. Alice, Texas.
Yeah.
You already mentioned that.
Yeah, so, I don't need, before long we'll be on in Jacksonville, Florida. I think we're on with an AM station.
Yes.
But only three people listen to AM station in Jacksonville, Florida. So, if you're one of those three, you just won. What did they win, Ed?
Well,
they just won a,
they won a Walkman.
A free visit to our website.
They won a Walkman so they can.
Does anybody listen to AM radio anymore?
I don't know.
You know, well, the only thing you listen to AM for, I'll answer my own question as I interrupt you,
okay.
Ed, as a good
right.
host. I think your niche programming, like maybe your sports talk or some news talk.
The only time I go to AM is if I'm hunting for a ball game.
Right.
And so I can't find it on, you know, AM, I'm scanning, AM. And then I'll say, well, I might as well try AM. Maybe I'll hit the jackpot and catch a, you know, broadcast of a, you know, game X, Y, or Z.
You know what I remember? I'm going to take you a trip down memory lane, okay?
And that's
you,
awesome. That's, you I care love about that this. Place.
But this may be this will resonate probably with a lot of baby boomers, and that is when I was a kid. Because you may have done this yourself. When I was a kid, well, my parents bought me a stereo, a FM AM stereo,
for
like Christmas one year, and so I had earphones. I mean. And I don't know, I was 10, 11, 12. But what I enjoyed doing was at night laying in my bed and I would scan the AM dial. That way you wouldn't scan it. I mean, you tuned it.
Yes.
With a knob.
Right.
Is that?
Oh, yeah. And you try to wiggle in there in that perfect spot.
Well, what was
spot.
So fun was to me, and maybe I had a. Maybe I was easily entertained, but I would go down that dial and find radio stations all over the country, and I could name them for you. I would listen to them, you know, 840 WHS Louisville, WWL, I think it's 870 New Orleans. This is night, clear channel radio.
Yeah. And you could listen to places all across the
1120
nation.
Was St. Louis, KMOX. Yeah. Listen to the Cardinals there. 1100 was WWE. I think, or 3WE Cleveland. Anyway, you could get stations all, you couldn't get west of maybe like Dallas or San Antonio. It was a station out of San Antonio. But anyway.
No, why was that at night? Was it just something?
Clear channel at night. It would switch over from.
Oh, okay.
The daytime, AM didn't carry that far. But night, it was clear channel. And so you could get a station from 1,000 miles away.
I'll say this. There is really something special. Now, maybe a lot of millennials and stuff like that will go, I'm not buying this. But listening to a baseball game on the radio.
Right.
I mean, that's just.
Childhood memory that's
childhood
lost.
Childhood memories.
Lost
yeah.
for today. They
You're
get everything on there.
Those announcers.
It's not
the
same looking on your device, is it?
Right. And you know, those announcers, you know, it's different than watching it on TV because. You're watching it. The announcers know that, so they let you see stuff going on. But radio, man, they would just take you right to that game, and they'd they would add stuff and color commentary, and you'd just be going, man, this is just.
I know. It's so cool. I know that, I would have all those places memorized. 750 was Atlanta. So you could scan down the dial if you wanted to listen to games. This is back in the early 70s. You want to listen to games. You don't want to catch the Braves. You go to 750. Yeah. You go to Cincinnati Reds. You go to, I'm stumped on LA. Anyway, the Reds were on. All the teams. Chicago, Wolfman Jack.
Oh, yeah, Wolfman. Wolfman. The Wolfman. Wolfman.
All right, so there's your trip down memory lane for you baby boomers.
And you just never thought AM would go away.
No, I know. That's how we got talking about this.
I'd listen to the Bruins. I'd listen to the Bruins on radio.
On AM?
On AM.
At night?
You know, at the time, of course, the best, you know, rock stations were on
AM. How does hockey compare to baseball? Because I wouldn't know. I've listened to hockey before, but not on the radio. How does that compare to baseball on the radio? Baseball is such a slower paced game. There's so much more to talk about in between pitches and in between innings.
I love listening to hockey.
Right.
You know, I preferred watching it. It's a sport where the commentators just knew how to take you. You knew which way the teams were going. You knew what offsides, you know, was.
Right.
It's a little more nerve-wracking because, you know, when someone's approaching the net and about to shoot,
right,
it's hard for you to know without seeing it.
Well, baseball, you could sort of see it in your mind's eye.
Yeah. But, I mean, we've lost a lot of that ability.
Imagination.
You know, imagination.
Really.
To just picture it in your head.
Yeah. Those are great memories from my childhood there, just laying in the bed, scanning America.
You
know, I was the only one in South Haven, Mississippi that knew what was happening with the Cleveland Cavaliers post-game show.
Hey, now before we go to our next, to our first guest, I found a story that I think you'd be interested in.
All right.
We got
three or four minutes. Lay it on.
Okay. All right. This, for dog lovers, okay, this is a study. Researchers in Hungary have discovered that man's best friend really does understand some of what we're saying. And this is, I'm going to say something.
You're being serious.
I'm being serious. Researchers in Hungary scanned the brains of dogs as they were listening to their trainer speaking to determine which parts of the brain they were using. And they found out that the dogs actually process words with the left hemisphere and then the tone of the voice process with the right hemisphere, just like humans. Okay. And so this story says, what's more, the dogs only registered that they were being praised if the words and the tones were positive. Meaningless words spoken in an encouraging voice or meaningful words in a neutral tone didn't have the same effect. So, I've actually done this with my dogs. You know, you praise them, you know. Hey, Greta, you're a good girl. You're a good girl. And then sometimes I'll say, hey, Greta, you're an idiot. You just peed on the floor. I just can't stand you. Right. I'm going to give you away.
But you did it with a...
And I thought the dog doesn't know the difference. Apparently, the dog does know the difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did not...
Exactly. I said it backwards.
This is a study out of where?
Hungary.
You said it backwards. Yes. I got that.
You see what I did there?
Well, if it's out of Hungary... You can take that to the bank.
Those Hungarian researchers.
Well, those Hungarian
buddy.
Researchers on dogs. That's like Canadians on hockey.
Yes. You know, I thought you'd be interested because you. I know you're a big dog lover.
I never was. Well, I never was till we got this little Maltese about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Right, well, we got a lab years ago. That's I know whole another story.
Anyway, I thought that was just interesting. And cats also, the researchers found that cats also understand what you're saying, but they just ignore you. No, that's not true. Part's not true.
No, if other people have the Maltese we have is like 7 pounds. It's like a lap dog. I discovered why they call them lap dogs after we got this dog. They want to sit in your lap.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And be petted. But I would like to know from the Hungarians at some point. What the deal is with a small dog like that, and I'm probably not unique to my dog, who has this inner German Shepherd come out.
Yes.
Huh? So he stands at the door or at the gate, barking at dogs that are six times his size walking down the street, like, get out of my yard.
And big dogs a lot of times will...
Yeah, cower.
That's right.
Or move on. I don't know what the deal is. It must be like a small dog syndrome, you know, that they
have. Well, aren't they all like descended from wolves?
I don't know, but my little dog, I'm like, of course, talk to your dog. You start talking to your dog after you've had your dog long enough, and you go like, you don't want a part of that.
Yeah.
You don't want that. You don't want him to come over here.
That's right.
And call your bluff.
A dog needs to know its limitations.
You're 7 pounds. To paraphrase, he's 70. You're losing.
Yeah.
Okay? You're losing that one right there. All right. You're listening to the radio program Pets Today on Hungarian Family Radio.
Hungarian Family Radio.
All right, Ed, why don't you get us back on track here for something more substantive.
All right. Well, we want to welcome to the program David Harms, who's a spokesman with India Partners. David, welcome to today's issues.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been enjoying the conversation. So.
I hope you learned something, though. That's an important thing, David.
Well, I was going to say, I remember listening to KDKA out of Pittsburgh.
That was a there you go. Pittsburgh station, Steelers, our Pittsburgh Pirates, KDKA.
Yeah.
Is that around 1,200 or so?
1080.
1080, wow. Yeah. I think that's the first clear channel AM radio station in America right there.
Wow.
I think so.
So anyway, that's I knew I was taking somebody down memory lane there.
Yes.
David, what do you do? What's your day job, brother?
Well, I work with India Partners, and we're just thrilled at what's been happening today because of the generosity of everyone across the AFA family of networks. We're trying to raise the money today to build an additional orphanage and children's home in India. We were here last year about this same time, and boy, the family came together and provided the funding, and we were able to expand a children's home, add a couple of floors and the furnishings in it. Well, what happened shortly after all that was completed was the government changed their mind. Gee, who'd have thought that? And they decided to change the code so that now we have to run totally separate facilities for boys and girls. We had boys and girls on different floors. Well, they said, you can't do that anymore, and they didn't give us much time to fix the thing. So, in other words, we only have till September 15th to actually break ground on a children's home for boys separate from the girls. And so the good news is we were able to purchase the land, get it prepared, the site's prepared, the permits are all now in and approved. We are just trying to now raise the money for the actual physical building to go onto that land. So, and that would be for boys, and that'll allow us to take on more boys in the orphanage. And in the current home, it would then allow us to even, bring in more girls as well. So great expansion, but we do have this little hurdle of raising $148,000 to build the boys' home. And we got to kind of raise that money and start breaking ground by September 15th.
Okay, just to set up what we're doing here today, for those who haven't been listening to AFR this morning, we're raising money to build this boys' home. Is that what we're doing?
Yep, that's what we're trying to do.
And so we're working with you guys, India Partners, and you've been around a long time. You're very... Mm-hmm. You have a great reputation, and so we're working with you guys. So we thought, hey, what a wonderful idea for our listeners. Just this one day, we'll just take an offering, if you will,
right,
and see if we can't raise the money you need to build this boys' home. Now, how do people make a gift, Ed, if they want to? And this just one time donation,
yeah. Right?
So,
well, we're asking folks, they can go online if they prefer to do that. They can go to AFR.net. That's going to be front and center what we're doing today with India Partners. Or they can call 800-256-1677. That's 800-256-1677.
How much money have we raised so far today?
Well, as I said, we're looking for 1,000 people that would give an average of $148, and 396 have done that. So we're at almost $59,000 on our way toward that. So lots of progress, and certainly hoping that more people will step up. And again, it's an average of $148. That's just nice round numbers, 1,000 people giving $148. But you opt in at the level that works for you. We had someone just not too long ago, Kristen from gave $4,000. And the person before that gave $5. So, you know, it kind of runs the spectrum there. But thankful for every gift.
Amen. We're talking to?
Yeah, we're talking to David Harms, who's a spokesman with India Partners. We are trying to get a boy's home in India break ground. They have to break ground by September 15th. That's the requirement that the government has set on them.
Where in India, by the way? Not that I know.
It's in southeast India, about an hour outside of a city called Rajahmundry, this ministry
Rajahmundry
is. It's very remote. Yeah, very.
Don't you go
used to listen to that on radio, didn't you, Tim? Did
yeah,
you
I think
to
that was like
some of the cricket games coming out of Rajahmundry.
Yeah, those were the days. Listen to those
clear,
things.
Clear channel.
The cricket games and turn the radio off and hear crickets. It was a double cricket night. Hey, Jeff and Ann Reed are in studio with us. They're on staff here at AFA and AFR. And we pulled them in here last minute because last year, right?
Yes.
Last year.
January. So I guess it was
January,
still this year.
A year ago, January. Yeah. You two, they're a married couple, not anyway, brother, sister.
Right.
And anyway, I just for those who don't know, Jeff and Ann, they went to India to eyeball the work of the ministry they were partnering with now, India Partners, and see what they were doing. And, you know, because we want to check things out. And Jeff, when did you go? You said you went a year ago, January?
It was this January.
So you flew over there to India?
Yes.
Didn't take a boat?
No.
Decided to fly. So how long, so you went to, well, you flew from New York or Atlanta or where?
Yes, Newark to
Mumbai?
We went to Mumbai.
Mm-hmm.
Mumbai.
And then Mumbai
about 16 hours
to where?
Mm.
We spent quite a bit of time in Mumbai, and then we actually went to this area where this orphanage is.
What David's talking about?
Yes, and we ate at a wonderful restaurant in Rajahmundry. That was my favorite meal.
Did you have curry?
Yeah.
Everything has curry in it, that's for sure.
I know. So you went over there, but what did you go over there for, Ann? I mean, I mentioned the reason, but I mean, you actually went to the facility where AFA and AFR people donate to help build, right?
Right. We spent quite a bit of time with Pastor Eleazar and his wife Prima, who do all of the hands-on work there with the orphanage, soon to be orphanages.
Are they Indian?
Yes, okay. They are. Wonderful, just godly couple who they just absolutely pour their lives into these children. And
how many children?
You know, I don't actually know the number. It is a
there would be more if there was more room.
Right.
That's for sure. The need is there.
Well, David, what are the kind of folks that everybody needs to be reached in the world who don't know the Lord.
Yeah.
But you're talking about some people here, if I remember correctly, Jeff and Ann telling us about would you consider this a red light district area or a drug? I mean, what kind of folks are you dealing with here?
Well, the children that come into this particular children's home and orphanage, they can come from all different kinds of areas. Some of them have escaped slave labor. That could be trafficked areas. Some of them have just been abandoned on the side of the road. It's a very poor area. And so they come from a variety of different places when they get to us. But once they're in, then as Jeff and Ann would know, I mean, it's a very religious culture. Hinduism is the predominant religion, and they believe in many gods. And so, the idea that this is the Christian place is a kind of a different concept. And so that's one of the reasons this September 15th deadline is so important, because the government would have every right on September 16th to come in and say, hey, we passed the law. This is what it is. We have to remove these boys and put them in a government program, a government orphanage. We don't want that. We want them to understand Jesus. And that's why the phone call is important and going online is important. So
how much money you need
to
raise?
We have a phone number that people can give. Yep.
How much money?
We need to raise $148,000 today, if we can do that today. And
is the money,
we're asking
if we don't reach the goal, what happens to the money? Is it all lost?
Well, no, we'll kind of pool it and we'll work on some other places to raise the money.
We're going to believe that it's going to happen. I'm just asking. You know, are you, having to make this financial commitment to the government, and then if you don't reach the deadline, you lose all that. I just want to make sure that wasn't going to happen. No.
We're totally separate from the government.
Okay. What's the phone number to make a gift and where online?
Sure. It's 800-256-1677. So 800-256-1677. And then AFR.net has a link and banners and information as well. We are at 396 people that have stepped up with that gift of $148. So well on our way, but it would be certainly nice to get that closer to 500 sometime here in the next couple hours.
And these
then
are
keep,
orphans.
Keep moving on to 100.
These are orphans we're talking about, right?
Orphans and those that have been totally abandoned. There are plenty of kids who have no idea who their mom and their dad are simply because they were left.
What kind of Christian witness are you giving them?
It's part and parcel of what we do. There is no separation of this. And Jeff and Ann, you've seen it. Mm-hmm. Pastor Eleazar and his wife, they have a heart for the Lord and for evangelism. They, in addition to this children's home, plant churches in the area. Mm-hmm. They have a goal to plant 100 churches in the next 10 years, 10 churches a year. There's definitely evangelism happening in incredible ways, and the children are certainly very open to this and desire it. So we're happy to present the gospel, happy to talk about Jesus in every way, shape, and form, and children respond very nicely. That's where they find their real identity is in Jesus, and that's why we don't want them to have to be taken out of it and put into a secular home. And so that's why this is important, and again, why we're hoping that we can hit this goal, build this other home, so there's no risk of them being put into another place.
And what do you remember about the trip?
Well, I wanted to add that we were actually there when the second floor of that building was being built, and we actually were able to have a part in that. We were actually able to physically lay some of those bricks and mortar and play a part in that. And the first time that we walked into that orphanage, I think the thing that got my attention is it's very different from what we would see here in the States. It is just very, very basic. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very crowded. I mean, you would walk into, you know, one of the little girls' rooms, for instance, and just bunk beds to the ceiling, you know, so close, just inches apart from each other, just completely packed space. The children, just the most beautiful, bright eyes you've ever seen, just beautiful, precious little children.
And, so, the family is a big deal there. So Pastor Eleazar and his wife, this is their family. And you can see it on the children.
All these children.
The children love them like mother and father. And in the Indian culture, that's very important.
It's 24/7, too.
Yeah, they don't. It's not just an
orphanage. 5 o'clock like we do. They don't go home and escape from the orphanage.
No. Right. They stay with them as they grow up and as they leave and do pursue their own career. Let me tell you something about Pastor
20 seconds.
Eleazar, too. He has a very simple faith. You ask him why he does this, he says, because Jesus told us to. I mean, it's just real simple to him. And he doesn't have believers there. He says he has disciples.
Amen.
All right, folks, we're asking you to go online at AFR.net if you want to give to this project of India Partners. AFR.net, or if you don't want to go online, you want to call. The number is 800-256-1677. That's 800-256-1677. We're trying to raise $148,000 today, folks. We are, I think, about 40% of the way
we're just asking for a one-time gift, whatever you can do to help to build. Expand the children's home and orphanage for the boys and girls there in Southeast India. We'll be back momentarily. Stay with us.
Next time on Today's Issues, we plan to talk with Dr. Alex McFarland and finish off question number 21 of his book, The 21 Toughest Questions Your Kids May Ask About Christianity.
There are a lot of Christian thinkers that would say, really, We shouldn't change the design, the way God made us.
We'll also talk with Bob Russell, author of After 50 Years of Ministry. That's on the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on AFR.
On the first day of our tour of Israel, we will stand on the Mount of Olives and look out over the old city of Jerusalem. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. March 9 through 17, we'll be going to Israel, the Holy Land. This is 2017, of course. We'll be flying from New York City, JFK Airport, direct to Tel Aviv, and then we'll begin our 9-day tour of Israel, including Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Jericho, Tiberias, Nazareth, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and all the places you've read about since you were a child in the Bible. For more information on this tour, you can order a brochure by calling us at 800-FAMILIES, 800-FAMILIES, option 5. Also, you can visit the website twholyland.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and Commentary next. We already knew that Colin Kaepernick was a second-rate quarterback, but now we know he's not a patriot. The other day, he refused to stand for the national anthem, said something about how America was oppressing black people. Now it would be easy to dismiss Mr. Kaepernick as an unpatriotic, spoiled brat whose only discernible skill is to throw a football, and according to the experts, he doesn't even do that well. But I believe his accusations merit further examination. For example, he says there are bodies in the streets. Where are the bodies? Show us the streets. He also said people are getting away with murder. Who? Name names. Critics say his protest is about freedom of expression, but it's not. It's about spitting on America and disrespecting the men and women who gave their lives so this repugnant man could make $19 million throwing a football. Oppression, my eye. I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. I'm Tim Wildman with Ed Vitagliano. You know, Colin Kaepernick, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, been in the news because he sat down during the national anthem. I guess it was Saturday or Friday night. I've forgotten which one it was. Preseason game. All his teammates and the whole other team stood up for the national anthem. Well, Colin Kaepernick sat on the bench with his uniform on. And after the game, you know, he was asked about that. And gave his reasons why he didn't respect America, so he wasn't going to stand up for the flag or for the national anthem. Well, Brian Fisher has written a column on this, an excellent column that you need to read. Hey, can we post this on our Facebook page, by the way? Brian's column, I know we have it on The Stand, American Family Association's website, The Stand. Brian joins us in studio to talk about this. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, Ed.
49ers fan for a long time, right?
That's right. Yes, I have been since I was 13 years old.
13 years. Who's the quarterback? John Brody?
That was back in the John Brody days.
I remember John Brody. I was a Rams fan, and the 49ers would always knock us out of the playoffs.
With Roman Gabriel.
With Roman Gabriel. Yeah. John Brody, man.
Roman Gene Washington
and some of those names.
Yeah, Roman Gabriel broke our hearts a few times up there.
That 49ers-Rams rivalry.
Yeah, well, it's about ready to maybe be rekindled.
That's
with
right.
The Rams back in that, L.A. now.
Los Angeles.
That's true. So what happened, Brian? Was this Friday or Saturday night, the preseason game? Was it in San Francisco?
Yes, it was a home game. It was in San Francisco on Friday night. It actually sat down for another preseason game, but nobody really noticed.
This time
it became evident, and the word was out. By the way, the New York Giants, the very next night, Saturday night, they all made a point, the whole team, lining up on the edge of the field while the national anthem was being played.
Good.
It was like a silent but very vivid response.
What did Colin Kaepernick, what reason did he give for
for sitting down during the national anthem.
Well, he clarified that on Sunday that it was really about a protest against police brutality. He used that phrase several times. Some people thought maybe he was talking about the military. He said, no, I'm talking about police brutality. So, and one of the observations I've made, it looks to me like a guy who's getting his information from the low information media, because they have one interest in these encounters between the police and young black men, and that is that the police are bad and the perpetrators are good. And if they get any information that exonerates the police, they're not interested in reporting on that. So it can give a very one-sided perspective on these encounters, and I think maybe that's what Kaepernick absorbed.
Well, he also said he was protesting the oppression of black people and people of color in America.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
In general, he's going to protest that.
Specifically exemplified in police brutality.
Okay.
Brian, by the way, excellent article. And folks, you can read this. You can either go to The Stand, which is on AFA.net, or we're going to post it on our Today's Issues Facebook page. Listen, one of the things I really liked about the article, Brian, is it's very balanced. This is not one-sided. You talk about the fact that we all have to admit that America's past has not been, you know, completely clean or clear of mistakes. And you talk about slavery. By the way, I did not know.
Good grief. Something. Are we going all the way back to slavery?
I am for just a moment.
I'm sorry, Tim. Ed. Go ahead.
Okay. I did not know this, but you mentioned in this article the kind of slavery practiced in the United States was actually a death penalty crime in the Bible.
Absolutely.
That the Old Testament forbid the kidnapping of human beings and enslaving it. I didn't know that. I read that.
And in fact, when a slave trading ship came to the Pilgrim colony, Plymouth colony, they actually imprisoned the owner of the ship and sent the ship with the slaves back to Africa at their own expense.
So this is a country, you also mentioned, a country that abolished slavery, Jim Crow laws, racial segregation, I'm quoting now, and has twice elected a black man to the highest office in the land. You talk about how black athletes especially have prospered in this country. So this really does seem, it seems to me that you're exactly right. Your insight here is that Colin Kaepernick has been absorbing the low information media's take on race in America. You also point out the fact, which I want you to comment on, the fact that the media lives for conflict. You know, the old expression in the newspaper business, which I was in for several years, is if it bleeds, it leads. That's you want people picking up the newspaper, so you put crime, murder, and mayhem on the front page so people will buy it. It seems as if that's the same thing for television news.
Yeah, and then when police are exonerated in one of these shootings, that winds up kind of in the back section, in the metro section. And you think about the number of myths that are out there that have been perpetuated that a lot of people still believe, the hands-up, don't-shoot thing. You know, there was nothing
Ferguson,
to that.
Missouri.
Never happened.
In Ferguson, it never happened. But you get the impression that maybe Colin Kaepernick believes that that's the way that went down. You look at Baltimore, where you had those six police officers that were charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of Freddie Gray. The first was a hung jury, one vote short of a complete acquittal. An African-American judge acquitted the next two cops that were on trial. They dropped the charges against the rest. So they were exonerated. They were acquitted in a court of law. And it's as if that never happened.
What you guys have been talking about is setting the backdrop or the talking about the reasons why Colin Kaepernick protested the national anthem on Saturday. It didn't stand up. And you're saying his reasons are, it sounds like his reasons are based on false information and a false narrative. Now, he would say, you know, I don't know what he would say exactly. He just sounds like he's sort of watching the news and then basing his opinion on the news. But let me ask you this. Even so, to not stand up for the national anthem is carrying it. Brian, you talk about this in your column. We're talking to Brian Fisher. He wrote a column called Colin Kaepernick, Islam, and the Media. We haven't even talked about the Islam aspect of this. But to not stand up and at the national anthem is a – because your perceived injustices across America, you know what? You're never going to stand up if that's your standard, because we have 330 million people in this country. And guess what? There's always going to be something in the news that you don't agree with, that you think is wrong. So when is Colin Kaepernick, when is he going to, what does he have to say?
Yeah, you know, and Mark Twain had a great statement back in the 19th century, support your country all the time, or love your country all the time, support your government when it deserves it, when it's right. And what the national anthem is about your country. It's not about the government right. that's in power at the time, whether you agree with their policies or like them or not. I mean, right now we have major problems with the policies of this administration, but we still love our country. We love the flag. We salute the flag. And that's, you know, and the national anthem has been a powerful unifying force in American culture, because everybody on both sides of the field,
right.
they stand with respect. Everybody in the
stadium, Democrats and Republicans. And,
yeah, regardless of whatever, they all stand. This is something that unites us, brings us together, because it's a way to express our love of our country and the ideals it stands for.
He's hurt himself, hasn't he? Don't you think overall?
Yeah, I think so. You know, back the NBA had a player back in the 90s that refused to stand for the national anthem. He was out of the NBA within 2 years playing basketball in the European League. So I think this is going to be – it's going to be tough for Colin Kaepernick to come back from. So far, he hasn't had any other NFL player join him. There was a rookie linebacker for the Eagles that said he was going to join Kaepernick. He's changed his mind. He's backed off of that. A lot of criticism from former 49ers, like his former coach Jim Harbaugh criticized him. Jerry Rice has criticized him, who was a black superstar in the NFL. So he's going to, I think, find things pretty lonely, the stance
he's
taken.
He's painted himself into a corner, because he said, I'm not going to stand for the national anthem until there are significant changes. Well, first of all, we don't know what he's asking for.
Right.
And second of all, where's the bar? I mean, at what point do you say, okay, there's been significant changes, now I'm going to stand? He's going to do this, and I think he's going to continue to draw the ire of
fans. I think he'll
fans.
Be that. Some way or another, I think the 49ers will – get rid of him. You know, they owe him $11 million, though, even if they get rid of him. So,
you know, one quick comment. Buddy Ryan used to be the coach of the Chicago Bears back in their heyday in the mid-'80s. And I read this past week that what he would do is he would film the playing of the national anthem before a game. He'd film his players. And if they so much as twitched during the playing of the national anthem, it was a $1,500 fine.
Wow.
This is Buddy Ryan you're
Buddy
talking
Ryan,
about?
Buddy yeah. Ryan, yeah. He didn't mess around.
And those yeah, great defenses, too.
You know, and the good thing about it is this is one person. This isn't a widespread at all. It's not even, in high school, college, or professional sports. But Brian mentioned, if this were to catch on, can you imagine half the teams sitting down for the national anthem?
It would tear teams apart.
And colleges and
tear
high
cities
schools.
Apart.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, we need more division in this country.
Right. So
thank you, Colin Kaepernick.
Colin Kaepernick. Brian Fisher, we've been talking to him about this excellent column he's written on this subject, Colin Kaepernick, the national anthem. And his column, Brian's column, you need to read it. It's at we
excellent
posted
column.
It, yes. We posted it at our website, our Facebook page, Today's Issues. And also it's at The Stand, which is American Family Association's website, The Stand. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All right. Talking to Brian Fisher about Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, who refuses to stand for the national anthem. And you know what? This is something where you got to think about more than yourself, Ed, in this situation. You're in a professional working environment here.
Right.
And you're putting all your teammates – and your organization in the spotlight over something that you know what I'm saying? What he were to do on his own time and his own dime.
Exactly.
Is his business.
Right.
Okay, when he takes a uniform off and goes out. But you got a uniform on, you're working for a company.
Right.
And you're working for the NFL. And so I don't see why the NFL allows for this.
I agree. I think this should be a fine. I don't think you should force players to put their hands over their hearts
right.
or sing the words
right.
if
you
they
stand
don't
up,
want
though.
To. But you stand up, just like there are other rules and regulations for behavior that the NFL, you are required to speak to the media. Certain
right.
players have to go.
Dress codes.
You
can't say anything about a gay person. You're going to be sent out.
Which we know from Don Jones, the cornerback for the Miami Dolphins a few years ago.
NFL doesn't tolerate that, but
right.
they'll tolerate sitting down
on
the
his own time.
Anthem.
He
right.
made a comment when during the draft, 2014 draft, Michael Sam was shown kissing his boyfriend, and Donald Jones simply tweeted out, "Oh, that's gross."
Right.
He was fined and forced to go to sensitivity training before he could do any practices.
Yeah, there was no free speech for him.
That's right.
He was a Miami Dolphin. He tweeted on his own tweet account.
Yeah. His own time.
And he didn't like seeing a man kiss a man open mouth on TV. That was gross. And that's what America thought, by the way. And the NFL said, you can't think that, and you certainly can't say it. We're sticking you with a fine. You're going to sensitivity training, or you're out of the league.
Right.
So the NFL said, we will not tolerate an observation by one of our players that a gay man kissing another man is gross. But national anthem, it's free speech.
Right.
If Colin Kaepernick doesn't want to stand up. So explain that standard to me. I don't understand it. But anyway, be that what it is. I think it's going to overall hurt the fellow there, Colin Kaepernick, and it puts his teammates in a bad way. You're listening to the radio program, Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Our next guest is...
Yes, I want to welcome Detective J. Warner Wallace, who's also a missions leader and church planner. He's author of the book. This is cool. It's called Cold Case Christianity. A homicide detective investigates the claims of the Gospels. And Warner Wallace is here with us on Today's Issues. Welcome to the program, Warner.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So it's a great idea. I mean, the fact that a homicide detective investigates the claims of the Gospels. And I got to tell you, I watch every once in a while NCIS. My wife's a big fan. And so Cold Case is something that a lot of people know about. I'd never heard of it, 10 years ago until the CBS show. What is Cold Case detective work? And then how did you apply it to Christianity?
Well, cold cases are simply unsolved murders. Pardon me. There's only of every crime we have in America that has some statute of limitations, but murders don't have a statute of limitations. They stay open, so we can go back and look at those cases years later. My cases are somewhere between 1979 and 1988, right in that range. So these are just old unsolved murders.
Okay, so you applied that kind of idea, and you were a detective and investigated cold cases, right? So
that's right, yeah. We had a team that we opened up, and I was one of the founding members of that team, and so we went through a lot of our old unsolved. And, I was an atheist until I was about 35 and really was not interested in the claims of Christianity and really thought they couldn't be supported. And most of my friends who were Christians were police officers, and I had a few, and when I would ask them why a particular suspect is the guy they think is guilty of the crime, they could give you five or six good reasons. They were very much evidentialists in their professional work, but if you asked them, why is Christianity true? Well, then all of a sudden they were speechless. I mean, they didn't really have any. I mean, give me five reasons why you trust the Gospels, and they really couldn't give me those answers. And I just thought, well, apparently there's two different ways that these folks think. They think evidentially about the things that matter, that the things that ought to matter even more, they don't think evidentially at all. And I thought, I just can't. I'm just not. That's not for me, especially given my background as an investigator. So when I first looked at the Gospels, my whole important focus was, are these reliable eyewitness accounts? I mean, do they tell us something that is actually true? And how will we know that? Well, that's very similar to what we do in cold cases, where you have, an account from 30 years ago written by a detective reporting something a witness said, and then sure enough, 30 years later, that witness is no longer available to us. And many times the officer who wrote the report is no longer available to us. So now you have a report documenting something from the past in which you have no access to either the eyewitness or the reporter of the eyewitness. Well, what does that sound like? It sounds a lot like, the Gospels. So I think, I thought, looking at this, why couldn't I apply the same techniques I apply as a cold case detective? Why can't I apply those to the Gospels? I think you can, and you'll learn a lot if you do.
But you were an atheist, and you didn't get very many good answers from the your fellow officers who were Christians,
right,
and you said,
right,
that's not for me. So what led you to start researching Christianity to begin with? Were you going to try to disprove it, or what was your motivation?
No, I'm a friend of Lee Strobel's, and I met him after becoming a Christian. But that was, how Lee was kind of, Leslie, his wife, was a Christian, and it was kind of irritating him. And so he was really on a mission to see, show it wasn't true. And that wasn't really my situation. My wife was not a Christian yet. but she was more interested in looking at it than I was. Given her upbringing, she was raised as kind of a cultural Catholic, and just wanted to know if this, you know, I think she had a sense when you're raising kids, don't you bring them to church to raise kids? I mean, that's that. I thought, well, if you want to go, I'm happy to go with you as an atheist, but I don't think it's true. But if it helps you, to, if you think it's going to help us raise good kids, fine. I thought it was useful. Like my dad's the same way, if I'm honest with you. He's a very committed atheist, but I think he would say that these kinds of things are useful delusions. And I would have said the same thing. And so when I first went, it wasn't that I was trying to prove it wrong or right. I just thought, well, to be honest, as I was reading through the Gospels, I saw things in the Gospels that bugged me because they had the attributes, the kind of the characteristics that I see a lot in my eyewitness statements in homicide trials. You know,
like, what?
Witnesses who say something slightly different,
yeah,
but they puzzle together perfectly. That's kind of what I was seeing in the Gospels, and I thought, let me go one more level and test this. And really, it was the attributes that I saw of reliable eyewitness accounts in the Gospels that got me interested.
So a lot of people, and by the way, folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Jay Warner Wallace, who spent a number of years as a cold case detective. He's written a book, Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. Well, let's just kind of, we've got about 9 minutes left, Warner. So a lot of people ask, and now we're, you know, a lot of Christians are facing a much more aggressive atheist, you know, community out there in the West, but also in the United States. So talk about the reliability of the Gospels. Let's stick to that. Folks can find out more about your other research and stuff from your book. Talk about the Gospels. Why did you begin to think that these Gospels might be telling something that was true and which eventually upended your atheistic worldview?
Well, there's four attributes of reliable eyewitness accounts, and we discover these by working with jurors. When we're in criminal trials, we ask the jury to take a look, hard look at the witnesses we bring in front of them, and to evaluate them in a number of categories. We give them 13 or 14 questions they can think about in their head as they're evaluating eyewitness testimony. It comes down to four large categories. One, was the witness really there when he said he was in order to see what he said he saw? Two, can we corroborate this? We don't need a complete corroboration, but we want some touch point corroboration. We don't necessarily have a video, but we want to know, can some of the stuff he said or she said be corroborated by other sources or other pieces of evidence? Three, have they changed their story over time, or have they been honest and accurate throughout? And four, do they possess a bias, something that would cause them to want to lie to us? Those four areas are of critical importance to us with eyewitnesses. So I simply said, if we took that template of four priorities and we put it on the gospel authors, could they measure up to what we would require of an eyewitness in a cold case? And as I did this and applied those four areas, I determined, number one, these Gospels are actually written early enough to have been written within the lifetime of people who would have actually seen the events. And that's a problem, because if you're going to lie, it's much easier to lie after everyone who saw this is dead so they can tell if you're lying. But if you're going to lie early and in the region, it's much harder to tell the lie. And so as I got to that point, I said, well, how about corroboration? Well, there's internal and external corroboration I write about in the book, both from simple touch point corroboration, like the statements of other early second, late first century non-Christians and what they say about Jesus and the Christians. Also, the corroboration of archaeology, internal corroboration of the use of certain proper nouns of certain locations and cities that are located in the Gospels. So I looked at that. And the third thing, of course, did they change over time? Well, you can actually trace that by simply looking at the chain of custody, I call it, of any piece of evidence. If John wrote this gospel, who did he give it to? Well, he gave it to Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. Well, what did they say about it? Who did they give it to? They gave it to Irenaeus. Well, what does he say about it? Who did Irenaeus give it to? He gave it to Hippolytus. What does Hippolytus say about this? You can trace what people are saying over time to see if the story is changing. And the last thing is, what is the bias that would cause them to lie? There are only three reasons why anyone commits a crime or even lies. Those are financial greed, sexual relational lust, or the pursuit of power. And as you examine the lives of the disciples in those three areas, you'll find quickly that they don't possess any of those motives that would cause them to be biased or want to lie to us. So when I got done with all of this and really kind of penciled it out, I was stuck with the Gospels presenting a Jesus who died on a cross and rose from the grave. And that's the problem you have with this, is that it's just you're stuck with those facts, those minimal facts. And then what do you do with those? That's the next question.
So what kind of response did you get or do you get as you present this line of argumentation to people who are atheists? You used to be, you became a Christian. How do people respond when you apply this kind of cold case analysis to the claims of the Gospels and the New Testament and the Bible in general?
Well, I always tell people that there are three reasons why anyone would shun the truth. I use that word shun because it makes it easier to remember. The first one is rational. Okay, I kind of cheat with the word there, but you get the idea. And sometimes people do hold an evidential, rational reason why they don't want to believe something. But that isn't always what's behind the denial. It's usually the other two categories that are far more active, and that is emotional. People have an emotional response to either something they've experienced from other Christians or in their own family. And the third one, I think, is one of the biggest, and that is volitional. It's that even if this is true, I don't want it to be true, and therefore I reject it. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, to be honest with ourselves, what is it that's keeping us away from this claim? Is it really a matter of evidence, or is it something else? And by the way, if it's one of those other two categories, you can show evidence all day long, and it'll have little or no effect on anyone, because that's not really why they're rejecting it. Now, of course, many people are, and that's where I was. I didn't have the other two categories, but by the time I was looking at the Gospels, I was really just interested in the facts. Is this true? But not everyone's at that point in their life. And by the way, God is the one who kind of gets you to that point in your life. But if you are there, where the facts do matter, well, then I think this is a good approach.
Our guest is J. Warner Wallace. He was a cold case detective for many years. He's also a missions leader and church planner. He's author of Cold Case Christianity, a homicide detective investigates the claims.
Can I ask you one question unrelated to this
absolutely,
topic?
Sure.
Hey, I'm afraid that this is my fear always when you ask me a question that's unrelated to this topic. Go ahead.
Well, it's related to your profession, though, as a police detective. What was the most bizarre case you ever had to deal with?
Oh, I tell you, the cold cases are, you know, I worked a lot of homicides and robberies before I worked cold cases, but the cold cases are always the most bizarre because they are, you know, there's a reason why they're cold. I had a case one time, for example, that we made on the basis of a piece of foam rubber that was left at the scene of the crime. And we figured out that this piece of foam rubber was actually a piece of foam that came out of a work boot worn by the suspect. But getting that, figuring that out and then kind of identifying it back to the boot was an amazing story. All these cases are on Dateline. And so, I think I've been on Dateline more than any other detective in the country. And so you'll see that that's called The Night Before Halloween is the name of the episode. It still runs on all the, you know, Dateline runs forever. If you do one Dateline episode, that one episode is going to run for about 8 years on different networks. So I'm sure people will get a chance.
So you guys caught the guy?
Yeah, he actually we identified the boot, recovered the boot, and it was about 30 years after the fact.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy.
You just always try to put yourself in their shoes. No pun intended here. Trying to be funny, but you're thinking 30 years afterwards, you're either continually racked by guilt, or you're thinking, I clean got away with it until that knock on the door comes.
That's right. And then when that happens, everything changes. And you can't convince these guys that everything's about to change, but it is. Yeah, it's true. No.
Where is that show on TV now? Dateline.
You mean Cold Case or Dateline?
Dateline.
It's, you know, it still plays on NBC, but it's also like an ID Discovery. It's on, I just saw TLC's got a version of Dateline. They're all over the place. They just keep on reformatting them, showing them all over the country. So I get calls all the time, I saw you on TV last night. Well, it's some old episode that I don't even remember, you know, where we did it. So
J. Warner Wallace, our guest.
We're out of time, Detective.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you
very much. The book is called Cold Case Christianity. We shall return after the news with more of today's issues on AFR.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.